Coming up on Digital Music Trends 178 on the 9th of April 2014, the latest on YouTube Music, Vivendi sells SFR, we hear from Ty Roberts at Gracenote on the partnership with Deezer for its rhythm platform, and we also hear from Paul Springer from Rhapsody about the company's latest numbers. We chat about the upcoming All That Matters conference and the latest developments in Asia, discuss music sales declines in Australia, and hear about the Big Sound conference in Brisbane, and we also mention AIM's startup fund, Prince's new publishing company, and Bacardi's Bat Video. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli, and this is a weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available on a variety of channels, including iTunes, most podcatchers, including Downcast, and, of course, the podcast app on iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, and many more channels. To get in touch with the show, you can tweet us on at DigiMusicTrends. And I hope I appear fully awake this morning to you, as it's 8 a.m. here in London. But I have two fantastic guests from Australia and Hong Kong. So it's a real pleasure to have Nico Byrne here, General Manager of the of AIR, the Independent Australian Record Label Association, and Executive Producer at Big Sound. So hi, Nick, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Very well, Andrea. Very well. Thanks for having me. And good to see Jasper there too.
Yeah, it's great. It's a pleasure to have you. And it's also a real pleasure to have Jasper Donat, who is the co-founder of Branded and CEO of Branded and the president at Music Matters. So hi, Jasper, and thanks for joining us.
Great to see you. Thank you very much for having us on the show.
It's great to have you. And so, of course, we're going to talk about your respective organizations and events. But I want to kick off the show by talking about YouTube. And as always, it's pretty hard to talk about a service as being hit by delays when a service has not been announced yet. And everything we're basing ourselves on is rumors, really. But according to sources, the YouTube music streaming service that was meant to launch in Q4, and this is reported by Billboard, has hit some roadblocks and may not launch until late summer. So, the key problem here, according to Billboard, is a product one, as YouTube is trying to figure out how to give a visual representation to tracks that don't have an official video yet. And so they're working on a bunch of different possible solutions, including, for example, having some stock footage that would go alongside the artwork and mix those up to create a compelling visual representation of the track. Of course, the majority of tracks that are on streaming services would not have an official video associated to them on YouTube, and so that poses a problem for the service. YouTube also seems to want to come out with a fully baked product, as opposed to what Google has done so far, which is release beta products that are beta essentially endlessly until years and years later they become non-beta products. And so they want to try and compete directly with the likes of Spotify and the new Beats Music, out of the gates, essentially. On top of that, there's an interesting thing to look at as well, because although the piece only mentions product issues, there was a session at Music Tank on Monday night where one of the, Simon Wheeler, who's the head of strategy at the Baggers Group, one of the biggest independent labels in the world, mentioned that he knows for sure that YouTube doesn't have all the deals they need yet, and hinting perhaps with his certainty to the fact that they don't have a deal with them yet. And so, of course, that's a big gaping hole in the catalog if they haven't managed to get a deal with Baggers or with some other of the big labels, big independent labels, So on that front, I'm pretty interested in your thoughts around YouTube in your respective territories as well. So, Nick, as far as Australia is concerned, is YouTube as present as it is, of course, here in the UK and in the US? I imagine it is. And if so, what is your take on YouTube and a potential music service? Would you welcome it, or are you worried that, that would just consolidate YouTube's dominant position and reduce the bargaining power of labels in the process?
I think we'd definitely welcome it. We've sort of worked hard to welcome the other streaming services, more out of pragmatism than anything else. Yeah. I guess if Simon's saying that he knows for sure that they haven't done all their deals, and he's talking about the Beggars Group or the Merlin thing, which Beggars is obviously kind of one of the shining lights amongst their catalogue. And if they haven't done a deal, then, no service is complete without, the kind of the huge and rich catalogue of those indies. Yeah. Doesn't matter how early you do the deal with the majors, you just can't compete with the other services unless you go right down the long tail and get the good stuff, because that's how you actually differentiate yourself.
Yeah.
So I reckon it's, I would speculate that that is the number one reason why it hasn't launched yet. It's, it's probably got nothing at all to do with the fact that they're looking to do, you know, slideshow imaging and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And Jasper, last year there was a pretty interesting sort of tie-up with YouTube as part of Music Matters. There was a sort of a YouTube Awards going on at the same time. And so how do you view the YouTube presence in Asia? And, of course, you know, a YouTube music service could be pretty compelling in those territories too, where there isn't such a big breadth of choice as there is here in Europe or in the US.
Yeah, look, I think the first thing you need to remember is Asia is not Asia. It's 28 different countries.
Exactly.
And so it's very hard to talk about one homogenous mass, and I include Australia in that. For the work that we do with YouTubers, and these are, you know, the stars themselves who have their own channels, so whether they're musicians or chefs or comedians or lifestyle vloggers, What we have seen since we did the YouTube Fan Fest last year, and we've since done Singapore, Hong Kong, and Mumbai, is that the influence that these kids have over their fans is second to none. It's unlike anything I've ever seen in the advertising industry or the entertainment industry in 25 years.
Yeah,
and that's very exciting if you can harness that. So if you then put that into context of a music play, and you've got kids all over Asia who are genuinely using YouTube as their source for new knowledge. It's the new radio DJ, I guess. Then if they can get the service right, and I buy into what Nick was saying, but if they can get the service right, then it can only be good for the music industry and then ideally for the musicians themselves because of YouTube's fantastically disruptive revenue model.
Sure, absolutely. And so, yeah, we're going to see what happens with that. I'm really looking forward to seeing the service when it comes out. It is an interesting thing to see, you know, no matter how late YouTube is to the game, I think they will always make a big splash in the market just because of the position they have. But they have struggled to get subscribers for their, you know, trial of premium channels, essentially, that were requiring subscription. So it's going to be interesting to see how they drive that transition from a service that is seen as being a completely free service to trying to drive some sort of payment system, whether that's you know, the usual $9.99 that everybody else is charging, or whether that's a lower price point, we don't know. But do you think, Jasper, that's the price point is going to be a key part of YouTube's process because of the way people see the service, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, again, using this horrible word Asia. So many Asian countries, thanks to piracy through the 90s and
right.
through the noughties, regard music as free, albeit that services like Spotify and Deezer and local services like KKBOX are really doing a lot to bring subscription services to the fore. Can YouTube charge? I think they'd be able to in some markets. I think the more developed territories such as Hong Kong and Singapore would be more open, and Taiwan and Korea, Japan would be more open to subscription-based models over markets like India or China. I mean, they're not in China, but India and China, where you're going to struggle.
Yeah, sure. And Nick, in Australia, we've seen a flooding of streaming services in the last year or so. We're going to talk about that in a little bit more depth when we talk about Australia in a little bit. But do you think that YouTube is just another service that comes into the fold, or can it really have an impact on the market?
Yeah, look, I guess they've got as much chance as everyone else.
Right.
And, you know, we saw Deezer sort of shut up office here recently, which, in my mind is not particularly surprising. They all entered at the same time. They rushed. But it's the services that have, taken a little bit of time and really put some thought and strategy behind the launch are the ones that are being strong in the market right now.
Yeah.
So Spotify, by virtue of its just overall presence, is doing, seems to be doing well. And RDO is definitely being the most aggressive from a marketing and PR campaign here.
Yeah.
And was the first to launch. The others, there's a few major label-based ones, which just, has barely made an impact.
Yeah.
I don't think Deezer made an impact. And I also, I wonder, I do wonder how YouTube is going to differentiate itself from anything else. Their advantage is that they've been able to provide so much content to consumers for free, and I just don't understand how that's going to translate to a streaming service, unless it's an ad-based revenue model, and perhaps that's their plan, in which case it'll probably work quite well, Jasper, in those territories that we were talking about, China and India, where consumers aren't used to paying.
Yeah, sure, of course.
But they're not used to paying, but they have got, YouTube have got, preface this, I'm a fan, right? I think what YouTube are doing are fantastic, but they've got huge reach they're not in China, but places like India, Indonesia, Singapore, and it's not just the reach, it's the amount of watch time that they're getting from kids as well. Kids are they're tuning into YouTube, they're not watching TV, so you've got to say that from a although they're late to market, they've still got an amazing kind of, I couldn't say head start, but they've got amazing reach to launch.
Yeah,
they're not starting at ground zero.
Sure, and it's a very interesting multifaceted issue here with YouTube, and I think the industry has got a love-hate relationship with YouTube. Although every time there a debate comes up, at least in the last few months, is around streaming, it feels like a lot of labels are, veering on the side of Spotify and other streaming services, being a little bit more cautious when it comes to YouTube because they're not seeing the revenues that they are hoping or expecting to see from a side that has got such a big reach. So definitely interesting to see how the relationship between YouTube and the industry is going to progress over the next few months, and whether the conversation is going to shift when it comes to also industry panels and industry conversations around the world. We're going to look out for what happens at Music Matters, of course, and a Big Sound as well later in the year. And talking about sort of large multinational corporations, I wanted to touch upon a news coming from Vivendi. So Vivendi has finally announced the sale of its SFR business in France to Numericable, which beat three to the bidding process. The sale is worth over $22 billion. This is an interesting sale for the music industry because it stresses and it reinforces Vivendi's commitment towards its media and content properties, and in particular Universal Music, which is sort of its prized possession, that alongside a few other of the big businesses that Vivendi has at the moment. And so, I think it's an interesting sale. It's a lot of money coming into Vivendi from it, and I'm wondering how that's going to be invested and whether that's going to in any way be invested back into Universal for acquiring, for example, other media properties. But is there a way for you guys, for Universal, to keep expanding, I guess, horizontally rather than vertically, in the sense that trying to get involved in more sideline parts of the business, like live, for example, getting more involved in that? Because I feel like if they try to acquire anybody else, there's going to be a massive fuss around the market share, and so that's going to be very hard for them. But if they try and expand in different areas, that might be a possibility for the company. Jasper, what are your thoughts on that?
One of the themes that came out of Music Matters last year and was the very real fact that music isn't the biggest leisure pastime on the planet anymore. It's gaming, right. And therefore for the music industry to grow, let alone survive, but to grow, they have to start collaborating. And it's not the other industries now knocking on their door. The music industry's got to go the other way, and they've got to start wearing their shoe leather out on the paper. And going and banging on the gaming doors and the movie doors and stuff. So, I think that the Universal are set up in such scale all over the world to do that. I think Asia is an interesting one for them because they've got a fantastic guy at the helm for Southeast Asia who's very, very progressive and very, very thinks very, very out of the box. So I know that they are looking at doing lots of new different collaborations and diversifying their interests into other areas. So yeah. I think to be in the music industry right now I've got a slide in a presentation that we do. It just says, it's got the Pointer Sisters on it, and it just says we're so excited because the only way is up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Nick, from your end, from an independent perspective, what do you think? You know, of course, the fact that Vivendi is prepared to invest in content and in their media assets in this way is fantastic, and the fact that they're concentrating on that is not a bad sign. At the same time, I guess there might be some unease from the independent sector to see the possibility of Universal becoming even bigger than it is now.
Yeah, sure. I can't see how they would be able to purchase more, given the divestments that they are forced to do when they purchased EMI. It's an interesting stage. So they have to look for other ways to grow. I think Jasper's point. That wouldn't have been the first thought that came to me, but it probably should have been. Investing in growing, growing models is something. That's what they'll end up doing.
Absolutely, yeah. And live is still a pretty open space. Like, there's still a room to get into the live industry in one way or another.
Yeah, look, I guess so. I mean, that's an interesting model. It depends how they go about doing it, I guess. If it furthers their kind of involvement and their reliance on kind of 360 deals with artists, I don't think that's a good thing for anyone, really. But if they're setting up entire new kind of silos of the company, I guess that's exactly what they're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. We'll keep an eye on this and see where this 22 billion ends up. And I wanted to talk about Gracenote. Gracenote announced a partnership with Deezer to bring the streaming services track IDs into their Gracenote Rhythm database. And I caught up with Ty Roberts, Gracenote's co-founder and CTO. So here it is. Well, it's a real pleasure today on the Digital Music Trends show to welcome Ty Roberts, CTO at Gracenote. So hi, Ty, and thanks for making the time. How's it going today?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. And so I want to talk about the partnership with Deezer first up. So what was that all about and how did it come up?
Basically what's going on is that obviously we've been participating in a lot of different hackathons that are going on around the world. Music Hack Day is one of the ones I think we've done in a couple different locations. I think maybe that was the third one or fourth one we've done. And the idea really is to try to get the developers to work with Gracenote's APIs and our partners' APIs to create some new experiences.
That's fantastic.
And this one, Deezer is one of the guys that we're working with here. We've been working with them for a while. And, of course, they have a pretty large global catalog. So we were able to ingest their catalog, match it with our giant catalog of music, and then make the IDs that connect things into Deezer's world available to the developers.
That's great. So they can connect the two things, right, on a practical level.
That's correct. Yeah, basically, if you think about it, we have kind of like different kinds of identification technology. So you can, hold up your phone and identify music playing in the air. That then leads to identification. And then as one of the things that comes back, the Deezer ID would be there, which you can then use to create a playlist or to do something with the Deezer APIs.
That's awesome. And Deezer have been very much involved in getting developers to use their API. And that's definitely an interesting tool in their arsenal. And so, I'm talking about the Gracenote Rhythm product, of course, how is that coming along? And have you been flooded by calls since the acquisition of the Echonest from Spotify?
Well, yes, I'd have to say we a lot of people have been expressing interest. But we had a lot of interest even before that, because I think that the main thing there is that it's powered by Gracenote's giant database, which I think is something like 180 million tracks right now.
Right.
And that global database basically feeds in there, and it really lets somebody create a global radio product that seems, I'll call it, local, even though it's global.
Yeah.
And so what's been coming along there is we've literally working with the first initial deployments right now. A few of the partners are starting to develop on it. I think the product itself will have some of these partners in the marketplace in a few months with this running, and the feedback's been great. I mean, basically, I think what people are excited about is the breadth of different kinds of music it works with, and it works with music in all kinds of different places and languages and things like that.
Yeah, sure. And looking at the partnerships with the data companies like Music Metric and Next Big Sound, so how do they fit into the picture of Gracenote Rhythm?
So how do they fit in? So we have all kinds of different data partnerships. I think right now Grayson gets something like, I don't know, 2,000 feeds from all kinds of different partners all over the world or from different things. And so these analytics companies really are providing a different kind of sensing data to us. They're finding out what's happening on Twitter, for example, or maybe what's happening in people are searching for different things, and they pull together all kinds of different analytics to kind of help us find the hot trending artists who are not yet hitting the sales curve. Like, you know, what's the newest, hottest things that are coming out? Who's really getting some? And so that kind of information will feed into our product so that when you make a playlist, for example, with the rhythm product or whatever, you'll get new artists in there as well as the ones you might expect. And that will be very differentiating. I mean, one thing people say about some of the other radio services that are out there is the playlists seem extremely narrow and there's never anything new, hardly ever, in there. It's almost like you know exactly who's going to come up almost before you play it.
Yeah.
And maybe that was good for the first versions of these products because consumers have reacted good to that. But now people want a little more depth. They want a little more local color. They want a little bit newer stuff. And so we're really trying to use these analytics companies to help bring that to us.
Awesome. And in a sense, it's interesting to see, you know, Grace Note Rhythm as a separate product, but it's also something that with all the data you're gathering through that, that's also going to improve the Grace Note, the core Grace Note product, right?
That's correct. And for example, let me just give you some ideas. So obviously we have a recognition technology. It's, you know, similar in function to what Shazam has, although we do kind of a for our partners like Sony and Sony Ericsson.
Yeah.
That product requires there to be servers loaded with content ahead of time so that you can identify it. And we can't load everything in our entire database in there because that would be too hard to search through everything. So we kind of want to, but we want to focus on the latest things that are trending because, of course, that's the thing people don't know, and that's what they might be actually trying to identify. If they're trying to identify the Beatles, we've got that. But the reality is, what's the new band that's just coming out?
Yeah.
And this kind of trending data will help us get that stuff to the kind of the front of those servers so it can be recognized quickly. That might not be there based upon sales because some of these artists, frankly, are YouTube artists or people who aren't even really necessarily even selling music in the traditional channels yet.
Yeah. And finally, I always want to end by talking about the API itself. So is it easy to try out? And if there are developers listening to the show, what's the best way to do that?
Well, first of all, they can just go to gracenote.com and then there's an open developer link right on there and they can go to that open developer site. All they have to do is like they have to sign like a little ClickRap license and they have immediate access. And there's help on there and there's documentation and there's people that can help them. And so essentially the idea is that I think a lot of APIs of Grace Notes are available through that service, both for music and for television, as well as some kind of new technologies we haven't even really put in the market yet. So it's kind of a little playground for the smart developers to go and explore, and I heartily encourage them to do that.
That's awesome. Well, Ty, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And so, guys, talking about Grace Note, Deezer, and sort of the bigger data plays, are you seeing a lot of movement, Jasper, when it comes to Music Matters, looking at sort of data issues and getting companies to talk about that? It's, you know, that's a topic that has definitely caught fire since the Equinest acquisition last month. And so is that reflected in what you're looking at for the conference, too?
Yeah, look, we've been close to the Grace Note guys since the first year. I think we did Music Matters. That's 9 years ago, and it's amazing what they've done. And the, you know, it's great to see the passion that they have. I mean, you know, Ty is the ultimate nerd, but you know, how much passion does he have in the music industry? It's fantastic, and the world needs more people like him. We do focus a lot. We've got a metadata workshop this year coming. We've also got an analytics workshop on the Digital Matters program.
Awesome.
Where we'll be talking much more about, you know, kind of programming numbers rather than creatively.
Yeah.
The Netflix story. It's huge. We always have metadata playing a large role in the program.
Yeah, absolutely. Nick, on your front, do you see this kind of talk around data and music data APIs becoming an interesting part of Big Sound later this year?
Yeah, certainly we do. You know, it's a big part for us as a indie label representation as well. It's definitely probably the biggest focus we have as an organization working with small labels right now. Is locking down, everyone's behavior with metadata.
Yeah.
And you see it time and time again. You see it from people that should know much, much better that you know, the way they treat their data is not pure, and it makes mistakes and it costs them money in the long term.
Yeah.
I mean, even as far as looking at, you know, some of the more simple aspects of metadata, you know, talking about the ISRC and the way that it's self-governed by different associations around the world. There's no central database.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really up to every individual label to keep their ISRCs in check, in order. And then as soon as you go across, as soon as you start licensing into other territories, you see distributors, you know, assigning their own ISRC. So all of a sudden, depending on where you're listening to the music, you're getting one or two ISRCs, and you know, it just causes a lot of problems. It's something that really has to be fixed, and that, you know, that's just one example. But in the end, given that the entire music industry is based on data, you know, if we don't have ways to properly mark and identify music, then the end user, and particularly the small guy, is going to miss out in a big way. That money will end up in black holes,
yeah.
And usually those black holes are sort of administered by, you know, various collection societies where the major stakeholders are the majors, and they'll collect that money.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, what you're saying makes complete sense, and it's kind of going back to the question marks that I heard at South by Southwest around the Global Repertoire Database project, the GRD, which seems to have hit some roadblocks as some of the companies that had pledged to fund the project are now backtracking and say that they don't want to spend money on that, which is a real shame, because, you know, the GRD could be really the key to unlocking the metadata from the world when it comes to music, and actually making sense of licensing rights.
And the question is, why wouldn't they fund it? I mean, you know, I have to imagine that it's based on self-interest. It's like they realize that once these things get aligned, once people really understand the exact way music is used, it might not be so good. Then they're forced to pay royalties the way they should, rather than making inferences from charts or radio data or whatever that might be.
Yeah.
So that's really disappointing. I mean, it's an inevitability that it... Old guy has the ability that we have the technology to really to track where royalties are due, you know, whatever type of royalty it is, but it has to be instigated,
yeah.
And it does need some people to invest.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's an interesting story. We'll keep an eye on it. But moving on from that, Jasper, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, Music Matters this year. So how is it shaping up? And is there any particular themes that you are focusing on in especially?
How long have you gone?
I'm taking notes, Jasper. Thanks.
I have to say, the Big Sound program it was awesome last year. So I think we've got friendly fire. It's our ninth year. We have a program which is now takes in digital entertainment, music matters, and a thing called social matters, which was a joint venture we have with the ad agency group Ogilvy,
right?
Which is all about brands, teaching brands about how they're socializing themselves, but all three of the programs are really focusing in on what makes great content and what makes great content that's shareable, and then how do you share it. And I think for the music industry, from what we're seeing, they've been overtaken by a number of other industries in this ability to share. A lot of the band, you know, we've got 70 bands coming to the festival this year, and one of the things we've asked for the first time is their social metrics. Because we want the bands that don't have social metrics to understand they need social metrics. If you don't socialize, you die. And so one of the big themes this year is that content really does matter. The other theme going through this on the music side of things is that if you're in a band, you're in a business.
Right.
We launched our Music Matters Academy last year, which was a great event. It was 150 musicians, invitation only, so they didn't pay to be there. And they got to meet, you know, real people in the real music industry doing real things. And the first question they were asked was, where's your business plan? Neil walked into this room thinking like, hey, I'm in a band, I've got tattoos, I'm really cool. And then they're asked for a business plan. And they're like, oh, we don't have a business plan, we're in a band, we're really cool. We, you know, and it's like, no, you're in a business and the CEO is the singer and the COO is the drummer and the where's your business plan?
Yeah.
And so we taught them how to at least define what success looks like to them. Do they want to be the biggest band in India? Do they want to be the biggest jazz band in China? Do they want to be the biggest band in the world? Do they want to be the new Lady Gaga?
Yeah.
And if once they've got that vision and once they've aligned and agreed within their band or if they're, you know, on that vision, then it's like, how do you get from A to Z? Sorry, what did I say? Z? Z? How do you get from A to Z? And that's a business plan. And yeah. By the end of the 2 days, these kids came out just with their minds, they were blown away. Right. And so that's another theme that we're going to continue on with this. Is if you're in a band, you're in a business.
That's awesome. And so where can people find more information about the festival there?
We've renamed it All That Matters, which I think is a little bit slightly overclaiming. But, you know, to have music, digital and social plus the YouTube Fan Fest, it's allthatmatters.asia.
Perfect. And so, Nick, I want to talk a little bit about Australia as well before we talk about Big Sound. So we've been covering Australia quite a bit on the show in the last few weeks because of the numbers that came out from the IFPI, which were showing, a definite decline in music sales. You know, it was a quarter decline, a 25% decline year on year for physical. And there was also an overall decline for the market, of course. Digital is growing, although the downloads stabilized with a growth of only 0.5%, and streaming is of course the big story because it almost doubled. It makes up close to 6% of the overall pie, but 6% is only 6%, so it's not huge yet. So from your side, how have you seen this drop, which has been steeper than we've seen on the physical front in most other territories around the world for 2013? How has that impacted the indie sector, and what can you see for 2014 in terms of streaming helping offset that decline, and whether that's going to be able to catch up in terms of revenues to what's being lost on the physical market?
Yeah, look, I think that when those stats came out, I was actually surprised and disappointed. I thought a little while ago, a couple of years ago, that we were about to see it plateau and perhaps even rise the overall revenues. And when I look at the data now, which I have in front of me, I guess what I found most disappointing is the not so much the decline in revenues, but the decline in just quantities.
Yeah.
There's lots of things that go towards the reduction, you know, just the general devaluation of copyrighted product, and even, you know, CDs are selling for less these days and stuff like that. So, you know, that's disappointing, and there's lots of factors. And some of those factors are as simple as, we have one huge physical retailer that sort of dominates the market here. And if they change their policies and start realizing that they're clearly making more money selling DVDs and white goods than they are CDs, and they give it less shelf space and less opportunity for a consumer to buy. So there's factors outside of there are conditions to do with local retail and the local retail environment which add to this.
Yeah.
I think when we look at, it's disappointing that you see a reduction in digital tracks being sold. You know, we would have hoped that was a huge increase. But, that sort of stuff changes between year to year based on who releases a hit song.
Right.
And, when you have a year in 2012, for example, when Gautier released a huge single and, it sold so much at home, and worldwide, and then we didn't have a local hit like that the next year. So that's enough to account for that.
Yeah.
I'm inclined to look at the positives and go, well, at least, streaming is picking up. We're seeing the ad supporter models, doing pretty well. But it's still small fry. And a lot of people here like to talk about the vinyl explosion, but that is still small fry too. We're talking like 5% of the industry. It's not enough to make a huge difference.
Sure. And have you seen that?
Go ahead. No. One thing I always like to talk about when it comes to streaming and the way it very, very tangibly affects the independent labels, which I think is not talked about because we have these discussions. We're talking about huge, on a macro level, the trends. But what happens is that if you're a small label and you're releasing, you know, 2-3 albums a year, perhaps, you know, let's say in the old days, you might invest, you know, $20,000 on something like that. And no, you know, fairly safe assumption that within 6 months, you're going to recoup that money. You probably only have to sell 3,000 or 4,000, records to do that. The streaming services quite rightly say that eventually you'll make more money. Yeah. You know, eventually for every sale that you used to make, that was a once-off transaction. Now you get millions of transactions, and it will 8 to 10 to 15 years time recoup. I guess the issue is that if you're not dealing with huge catalog,
yeah,
you know, no artist or small record label could possibly run a good business when it takes them 15 years to recruit and reinvest on the next release. You know, you need to churn product, and that's where the biggest danger is for small labels and streaming services, is that you just simply don't, it just changed the cash flow model completely.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I guess makes life very, very hard for the indies in the new business.
Yeah, absolutely. And that makes complete sense looking at also the figures that are coming out of the US. Last night, Nielsen SoundScan posted their Q1 results for the US, showing that the streaming business is doing great. You know, in Q1, streams jumped by 9 billion to 34.28 billion streams compared to the same quarter last year. And also the average sum paid per stream rose, you know, the average rate going from 0.035 to 0.05. Dollars, which means that it would take around 2,000 streams to make the same money you'd make from a wholesale release. And to your point, Nick, you know, 2,000 streams is a hell of a lot of streams for a wholesale release, considering how many you'd have to get to recoup those $20,000 you were talking about. It would take quite a while for an artist that is still in a development stage. The other thing I wanted to ask you, Nick, was about the size of the market, because Australia has remained the sixth market in the world. But in terms of number, it's by far the smallest in terms of population country in that list. So it's 22 million people, and that's a number that I like to point out when I talk about Australia, because it feels like that the shift between physical sales and streaming could be even more abrupt, in the sense that you have a fairly small population that is really into music and buys a lot of music. That's why you're the sixth market in the world, and I think you were fifth at one point. And if a lot of those music lovers shift gradually from, or you know, fairly quickly from buying a lot of physical CDs to streaming a lot of tracks, that's going to impact the territory more than in other parts of the world, where there's a pretty vast number of people who are sort of into music, but they don't spend a lot of money on it. Do you think that's a fair comment to make?
Yeah, I think if you look at it, and maybe this backs up your answer, given the other kind of territory to make news from that IFPI report was Japan. But if you look at those IFPI lists and look at the investment per capita in music, I think Australia comes second. We're talking, you know, a reasonable, you know, $25 Australian dollars, which is maybe 20, 22, 23 US dollars a year, you know, per capita spent on the music. And it's quite interesting when you talk to people, you know, speaking to people from the Beggars Group, for example, from an indie perspective, they view Australia as a strong market, and a really good, it represents a really good return on investment for their marketing dollar, because people do buy. We have a few issues. One of them is that, you know, just our geographically, it's a huge country, and we just don't quite have the infrastructure to have super fast internet connection. And so a slightly slower uptake maybe on digital services than it would be if we had great speeds and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe Jasper could talk to this a little bit. You know, when you look at countries that really have got their ducks in a row in terms of digital infrastructure, and I'm sort of talking specifically about Korea, which is an interesting territory and the way that they've embraced the digital services and their very fast sort of incline up the ladder of valuable music territories.
Yeah. Jasper, any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, where do you want to start? And there's 28 of them, but yeah.
Specifically about Korea, though. Yeah.
Korea is an amazing place, and you know, obviously with the fact that they're now starting to export their music as the first kind of proper Asian territory to do that, it just gets very interesting indeed. But they're you know at least 6 or 7 years now into having a legitimate streamed industry, online industry. So a lot of people used to come and still do come to Music Matters to learn from Korea and Japan and you know, markets where they have a sophisticated industry. I just have one little postscript on the Australian situation. Max Hull, the president of Universal Music Worldwide, who is going to be at Music Matters, there's a little plug, he got quoted as saying the reason the Australian music industry dipped was because they were doing so well in the cricket against England. And, there's no Ashes series next year, so everyone will go out and buy music again.
That's probably
but
true.
Look, you know, I think the world can learn a lot from countries like Korea. I also think they can learn a lot from countries like China, ironically, right. Where you know, piracy, IFPI listed China as 99% piracy last year. But there are, you know, if you're in a successful music business in China, even if it's a part of another service, part of another business, there's got to be some stuff to learn from them if they can survive in such an aggressive. Aggressive pirated market.
Yeah, and definitely it's going to be interesting to hear Ed Petro's insights as well on that, because he's been running a business there for a few years, so from out the street, right?
Yeah, look, Ed's someone, he's a case in point of how to do business in China.
Right.
He won't mind me saying this, the first time Ed Pito went to China, he turned up and said, this is what worked for me in London, I'm going to do it in Beijing. And 6 months later, he was back in Hong Kong licking his wounds, saying, I f***ed up. I got it wrong.
Yeah.
But he changed his model and he moved with the country and now he's doing really, really well. And so, you know, it's good for him. I know we've just diverted a little bit from the top. You know, I'll give him a free plug.
I was just shocked that you swore. One of those podcasts on iTunes with a little explicit box now.
Nick, sorry, just to go back to Big Sound, can you just tell us quickly what that's all about in case people are interested in it and how they can get more information on that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Big Sound, it does differ a little bit from Music Matters in that, you know, our focus is incredibly focused on the Australian live industry and the artists. It's much more, I think, artist focused than business focused.
Yeah.
And so what we have in Australia is probably, you know, one of the kind of richer A&R grounds in the world right now. And there's a lot of great up and coming professionals in Australia that are needing to deal with these mid-level buyers all over the world. It's my job to get people to understand that, you know, if you want to deal with someone like, you know, an artist like Flume or The Preachers or Jaguar Ma or Courtney Barnett, these are all people that are playing Coachella this weekend. They're all people that are kind of launching on a stream on a worldwide basis, that coming out here and talking to our promoters and our labels and stuff is actually important to visit the territory rather than to wait for them to come around to you, because generally that's too late.
Sure.
And then in terms of, you know, it's the entire Australian industry. It's the sixth biggest industry in the world. And it's a vibrant event. It's in Brisbane. It's a lot of fun. It's a really good party. We focus as much on kind of entertainment and the art of music as we do on the education and business of music.
Sure.
And you can find out all the information you need at www.bigsound.org.au.
Awesome. Perfect. Thanks so much.
Andrew, I don't know if you've been to it, but it is a genuinely awesome event. Yes. It's everything Nick said, and I think there's more of that as well.
Yeah, it's a long way from London. That's the only thing.
It's not that far. It's easy. You take a chemical upgrade on the way, and you'll be fine. But the look, when we were down there, we go every year. I was down there 2 years ago, and I got to meet with a lot of really cool band managers who were genuinely interested in opportunities for their artists that weren't the traditional America or UK.
Yeah.
And they've realized that there are markets like Indonesia with 240 million people that are 4 hours north of Darwin. And I have to say, since Big Sound, the number of bands we have coming to Music Matters has doubled.
That's awesome.
And I've got to say that's down to the great work that Nick and the guys are doing there, because it gave us exposure to a market. It gave the market exposure to us, and it's just been a win-win ever since.
Amazing. That's great. And yeah, I have heard great reports from friends as well. I know David Adams was from SoundCloud was at the event a couple of years ago, even last year. A couple of years ago, I think. And he loved it, absolutely loved it. So he definitely recommended it. And awesome stuff.
And, one thing I do have to say, and the reason I implore any listeners to go, or any listeners to, when they meet Australians, for a plug of our country's business, is that the market is, even at the investment level, or even at the level we were talking about, it's just too small to sustain a living as a musician.
Yeah.
So we are forced by nature to export, and that's, you know, that's why when Jasper sort of provides this platform to go in and investigate options and opportunities through Asia, we do it by nature. And that's what you have access to, these people that are incredibly hungry to go over the world, and usually working with businesses or catalogs or artists that are ready.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, a couple of stories to finish the show today. So first of all, I'm going to show you a quick recording of an interview I did with Paul Springer, the SVP of Americas and Chief Product Officer at Rhapsody, that I recorded just about 6 hours ago on PST time, talking about the company's latest progress report and expansion, which was a big news item of this week. So here it goes. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the show Paul Springer, SVP of Americas and Chief Product Officer at Rhapsody. So hi, Paul, and thanks for joining me on the show. How's it going?
Great to be here. Thanks. Everything is going well.
Great. And so I wanted to talk about the growth of Rhapsody's subscriber base. You released some numbers yesterday. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So we announced that we're just now north of 1.7 million paying subscribers on a global basis. We're now operating in 32 countries, up from about three year and a half ago.
Yeah.
It's been crazy. Outside of the U.S., we operate under the Napster brand, and in the U.S., we operate as the Rhapsody brand. But those growth numbers represent about 63% year-over-year growth in our paid subscriber base, and I think it was 16% growth just in the last quarter alone.
Wow.
We're really seeing that we're at that inflection point, and that now is the time to really introduce streaming music solutions to subscribers on a global basis.
Sure. So tell us a little bit about how it all worked as far as the European and South American expansion and how that came along.
Sure. So about 9 months ago, we announced a global partnership with Telefonica. As part of that partnership, they had we basically became the preferred solution, music solution, that was available to their operating businesses. Obviously, each of the decisions around music and how music fits into the strategies is done at the individual operating business level. So there's no obligation for their operating businesses to work with us. But we felt like we had a pretty compelling solution and an experience set that really gave them a great portfolio of choices that they could select on how they wanted to incorporate music into their own overall business strategies. So so this has resulted in partnerships with O2 in Germany, Vivo in Brazil, and across the rest of Latin America under the Movistar brand.
Yeah.
And so we've done a handful of integrations thus far, more underway. But primarily those integrations happen in one of two or three flavors. The first is just as a result of being a member or a subscriber at a given carrier, you can get a discounted rate on a music service. That's fine. Then other people are actually starting to bundle the music solution in with the tariff itself. And so that's the other mechanism by which you can really, really introduce music streaming to a large audience. And so we're doing all of those right now, in addition to just being available in the app stores and allowing any retail consumer to sign up on Android, iOS, Windows Phone, Firefox OS has launched in Brazil. And so it basically aligns with our goal to basically put music within arm's reach for any music fan around the world.
Absolutely. And it's interesting also because in South America, you find that different territories have wildly different economies and also wildly different, potential, disposable income potential from consumers. And so you really have to calibrate there the price point or the price of entry for a streaming service, right?
I think that's very accurate. I mean, I think through this process and our expansion there, one of the more dynamic conversations was between us and the labels around licensing rights and what are the price points that could be borne within each individual market. And that varies, and it's a function of, it's a function of how prevalent piracy is in the market. How prominent are the speeds for wireless data delivery in each market. So it also allowed us to innovate a little bit. We've introduced a weekly plan with Vivo in Brazil, primarily to get the price point down, but also to align with consumers and how they were using their own products. So I think this is the first weekly plan that exists out there in market, and it helps us really get that price point down for consumers.
Sure. And so talking about consumption, so of course mobile, you talked about how important that part of it is for the business. I wanted to ask you about the living room. We're seeing so many boxes come out, all of which, they don't really have a huge amount of support for music, but I'm sure that's coming in the next year or so. So do you see the living room as an important piece as well, that in the future for Rhapsody?
Yeah, I mean, right now we tend to think of mobile as dominating all of the consumption and listening, but I think the next phase, whether it's connected devices in the home, in the living room, or whether it's in the car, I think there's still a role to be played where mobile it still is the controller, even if the output or connection source might be something different. So just last week we announced Chromecast support for our app. So, what's the cost of Chromecast? $35. You can now, stream music to your TV, and if you've got great speakers hooked up to your home entertainment system, that's a great way for us to take a fragmented ecosystem and really streamline and deliver it there. In the US, we're also available on some of the consoles, on the Xbox in particular. And we'll continue, our goal is we want to be wherever consumers want us to be. We've previously done integrations with all the major smart TV platforms and applications. We didn't see a ton of uptake in that. It's a little bit of a version one experience of how people would consume music. And I think just using your TV remote to control music was just not a natural behavior for people. But I think, we'll keep investing. We'll keep iterating on that. I'm pretty sure that the home's important for us to figure out because that's where people want to listen to music.
Yeah, and hopefully in the next few months we're going to see a slightly more codified experience as well, because there's so many different manufacturers all requiring their own standard of app development, and that's so taxing for anybody trying to have a service on many different platforms.
Yeah, I mean, we support Chromecast, AirPlay for Apple, and AllPlay. So we announced Qualcomm, I believe, is leading the standard there with AllPlay. And so any connected speakers that are using the AllPlay chip will be able to be powered by Rhapsody and send your music from your phone directly into any of those connected speakers. And I think you'll see a lot more of that this holiday season and through next year. It also should go to say that I'd be remiss if I didn't note that at least in the U.S. and Europe, Sonos continues to be a primary platform by which early adopters, individuals with higher disposable income, seem to be wiring out, cutting the cords with their speakers and outfitting their home and really using Rhapsody to power their Sonos experiences. We were the first streaming service on the Sonos platform, and it continues to be a material source of subscriber usage for us.
Awesome. And finally, looking at the sort of the next 6 months for the company, what are your key areas of focus? Is there a particular territory that you're concentrating on right now, or are you still looking at a continuous global expansion on that front?
Yeah, I mean, we'll continue to expand globally. We'll continue to drive, now that we're live in each of those markets, we'll continue to drive both retail and partnerships in those markets to drive growth. And then we're going to continue to have a renewed focus on the U.S. I think, you know, this is our own backyard. It's more competitive than ever. You know, you're competing with Free in the U.S. in ways that you're not necessarily doing in Europe or Latin America at this point. And it's the most mature from the number of partners and industries that want to put music as part of a broader solution, whether they're an MVNO, a wireless carrier, or even just, you know, a retail consumer who's now, you know, awakened to the understanding, oh, here's what's here. Yeah, I've heard of Pandora, but what's the difference between Pandora and Rhapsody? Well, now that they're being introduced to that, let me show them the full on-demand experience instead of a limited experience. And so we're going to take a renewed focus and really trying to capture some of that latent demand that's out there right now.
Awesome. Well, Paul, thanks so much for your time, and look forward to having you back on the show soon.
Great. Thanks, Andrea.
During Monday night's Music Tank event on music streaming, Simon Wheeler, who is director of strategy at the Baggers Group, announced that the independent label is going to revise its 50-50 policy on streaming royalty splits. So Wheeler had announced the decision to go 50-50 with artists on streaming 2 years ago at another Music Tank event, in spite of the contractual obligations being much lower. Last night he said that at the time they thought it was important to make this royalty significant to Baggers artists, but they've always been clear that they would have to review this policy if streaming took off. And now that streaming makes up 40% of Baggers' digital revenues, the streaming revenues have to bear the cost of A&R, marketing, distribution, and all those covers that need to be made up by the sales income. Of course, he also explained that if they capped this rate at 50% and say that the company's margin was 20%, if they were paying 30% extra on what they usually paid for streaming, and streaming becomes the main source of revenue, then of course the company would end up being out of pocket and wouldn't be able to provide the same services to their artists. So definitely a very interesting statement, something that resonated through the industry, because Baggers had been sort of exemplified as a shining beacon of the new world when it came to splits because of their 50-50 policy. But the fact that they're revising it kind of makes us question whether that's a sustainable split, given that Baggers has always been seen as a very artist-friendly label. And if they could do a 50-50 split, there's a good chance that they would try and do it, essentially. And Nick, on your front, do you think that 50-50 is a feasible possibility for independent labels going forward, or is it too high? What are we going to see next when it comes to splitting streaming revenues?
Look, I think they were paying 50% of gross, which seems huge. I think,
yeah,
50%
exactly.
But I'm not surprised they made that choice. Well, I mean, Beggars are artist friendly, and they make the decision for there I go. They are artist friendly.
Yeah.
Sorry. But they also they run a very, very tight ship, and they're not going to make decisions against the interests of the company either. They're not a charity. They're not an artist charity. So I'm not surprised that they've done that. There are indie labels, good ones out there that are offering, 50-50, very traditional kind of joint venture 50-50 deals on across what they do.
Yeah.
I guess that they're not the ones that are investing maybe quite as much, or, their setup means that they're sort of outsourcing a lot of the, otherwise a label like Beggars might be investing in. I guess they're such a full service company, and they do so much in-house that, they do all their own digital, they do all that the PR and stuff.
Yeah.
They're a very complete multinational company, and their expense is probably quite high.
Yeah.
Because I did find it interesting that Simon said that he doesn't think anyone would be able to sustain a 50-50 model.
It very much has. So, as I said, it very much depends on how much they're investing in the artists and what kind of sections they have in-house and what kind of sections they outsource out of the company. Jasper, do you think that that's a thing that's going to come up as well at Music Matters in terms of, you know, there's a lot of discussions now if around whether... You know, if streaming services are paying 70% of the revenues on average, Spotify certainly is towards you know the music industry. The key question now is the splits between the label and the artist, because the artists are not seeing a huge amount of the revenue back. So, do you think that's going to be a big point of contention as well to talk about what split is fair at this point when it comes to money going back to the artist?
Yeah. Look, I'm not qualified to answer the question of what split should go where.
Sure.
I'll make that very, very clear. Secondly, you've just reminded me to Simon Wheeler does come to Music Matters every year, and I need to call him. You've just reminded me. So thank you for that. Look, there's a lot of digital throughout the whole week. We got Digital Matters, where you know finally the rest of the world has caught up with the music industry.
Yeah.
So we'll be talking about streaming video, streaming movies, streaming content, and then of course through music, there's a number of different sessions that cover various parts of streams. So yeah, the question will undoubtedly come up as to splits and what have you. So hopefully there'll be some good debate over that, and I'll be able to report back after the event
sure.
as to my thoughts.
Let us know. Exactly. That's awesome. Well, I think I'm just going to draw the show to a close. We are doing pretty... We have had a fantastic show, guys. Thanks so much for sticking around. I'm just going to run through a couple of quick news pieces before we go that we didn't get a chance to cover. So first up, AIM, the Association of Independent Music here in the UK, have launched a project called the AIM Startup Loans, a new government-supported initiative designed to help entrepreneurs off to a good start with a new business, of course, in the music industry. The scheme introduces successful applicants to experienced entrepreneurs who will act as mentors, and loans go from £1,000 to £25, and the average loan amount across the board is going to be about £5,700. And this is going to be definitely an interesting development for new businesses that want to launch here in the UK that are working on in a music vertical. And also, I want to talk about Prince. Prince has decided to bring his publishing in-house and created NPG Music Publishing, which has already worked on doing the sync for his track Falling in Love Tonight on the show New Girl. And the company is currently looking for other sync opportunities. And of course, they manage his entire catalog that he owns. So quite a lengthy number of tracks there that are accessible now through NPG Music Publishing. The agency group that represents the Black Keys, Gotye, Macklemore, and Ryan Lewis has signed a deal agreeing to refer select clients to Pledge Music, so that's a big win for Pledge. And I wanted to finish with a great post you should all check out by Elliot Van Buskirk on Evolver.fm covering Bacardi's campaign, and it involves Austin's famous bat colony. If you don't know about this, under the bridge of Congress on Congress in Austin, there's a huge bat colony that comes out every night in a big fly that is a big tourist attraction actually in Austin. And Bacardi have decided to film that event and assign to each bat that comes into the camera field a trigger on Ableton as they move around the screen, and so that essentially created a soundtrack made by the bats. So a great idea for a company that has a bat for a symbol, and definitely go and check out that video. It's on YouTube, but I've also linked to the story on Evolver.fm, so you can check that out there. And guys, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having us. Nice to talk to you both.
Yeah, thanks,
Jasper.
Awesome. As well.
Good to see you, Nick.
And thanks
good
so
to
much.
See you too.
And thanks so much for listening to the DMT show. You can find out everything on digitalmusictrends.com. The show comes out weekly. And also, you should check out the DMT one-to-one show, which is also a weekly show where I interview interesting companies, startups, and projects working in the digital music verticals. Thanks so much for listening. Have a fantastic week. And till next time.